Hey everyone, before we get into the episode today, I just wanted to drop a quick content warning for you. Today's film is Eat Me. It's a 2018 film directed by Adrian Cruz, written and starring Jacqueline Wright. Eat Me is a very intense film. I'll just read the synopsis here real quick. It says, over the course of one torturous night, a suicidal woman and the violent home intruder that saved her life test the limits of human endurance and the boundaries of forgiveness. As you can tell, this movie and by extension the conversation that Jacqueline and I are having in this podcast do touch on some fairly heavy topics, including suicide and self-harm, sexual assault, and depression. So please proceed at your own discretion. And if you are thinking about suicide or self-harm, please call 1-800-273-8255. That is the suicide hotline here in the United States. If you are out of the country, please visit suicide.org and find help in your own country. And now on with the show. Okay, hello everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Not Suitable for Anyone, and I am here today talking about a film that's very special to me, and I have another very special guest, and I know that I say that all of our guests are very special, and they all are, but today's guest is maybe a little bit more special than the other special guest, and that is Jacqueline Wright.
So sweet. Hello.
So Jacqueline, I don't know if you remember, but you were the first filmmaker that I ever interviewed when I started working for Modern Horrors several years ago.
I think I remember you telling me that, but it didn't feel like that. I thought it was I had a real good time on that interview.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So this is a reunion of sorts. So it's good to hear your voice again. How have you been?
Well, worldwide, you know, it's been weird, you know, but, you know, God, but my own personal person, you know, within my room is good, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
So personally, I'm really good. I think like a lot of us just navigating, you know, the craziness and sadness and everything that's happening around us, you know, so surreal. At least for me, it's surreal. So kind of, you know, balancing, you know, not just balancing, how much to kind of take in and, you know, and how that affects, you know, our personal lives, but also our creative lives, you know? Yeah. So I appreciate, by the way, I did listen to a lot of your podcasts and they're really fun. And I did watch Bagman last night. I'm just going to say that. I was like, I have to watch it. It's you know, sometimes you hear someone speak, well, I think as filmmakers too, a lot of us think like, God, it's just such a small ask, you know, just watch our movie, you know? I mean, Jesus Christ, I'll send it to you for free. Like, I'll give you the download link, you know, it's on iTunes right now for $1. But I'd heard you speak so much about it. And so I was like, I have to watch it. And there were a lot of things that really engaged me about it. And I laughed a lot during it, and but I could see your appreciation. I definitely could see much to appreciate about it. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out there.
Wow!
And I think the first line is "fucking ball sacks." Is that right?
I think that's right.
Is that like
right.
The very first line?
Yeah. No. Well, that I. Gosh. I mean, I really.
I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that's the first audible line. Anyway,
I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate you you watching it. And yeah, I mean that's just a you know, a fun, silly movie that I think struck me in the right mood.
Oh yeah, and you really do hope. I mean, I don't know what the filmmaker's doing now, but you do feel the spirit of him, and of course the spirit, the camaraderie around him, you know.
Yes.
Within that, you could feel it throughout the whole film, you know, and just yeah, and so there's something really, joyful about that kind of spirit. And you do hope, or I certainly hope, that that he's continuing down that path. Like I did see like he made, I think, like a Bagman something, like maybe a short afterwards.
Yes.
Like I didn't go any further than the one I saw. But yeah.
They did make a short, and now they are hard at work now on a new feature. And I've been getting some behind the scenes, you know, photos and things, and it looks fantastic. It looks a million times better than the first movie. So it's very exciting.
Well, that's exciting. It is exciting. I mean, as we all know, like just doing any movie is is a challenge. And but yeah, I'm excited to see what he does next. And I also really appreciated, because the heavy weight of recycling, which is actually, you know, in my film as well, a little bit of whatever. I definitely have some lines in movie about.
Yes. Yeah, no, there's a common thread there.
And horror of recycling. Or, you know, the responsibility, the heavy responsibility that comes with the need to recycle. So, all right.
That's great. Okay. So let's get into why we're here today. So you made a movie a couple of years ago. You wrote it, produced it, and starred in it, and it's called Eat Me.
Yeah, Well, what did I say? It was a huge dream of mine to get that film made. And, oh God, it took so long, so very long. A kind of a big part of that journey for me was simply just being able to finally kind of express this thing that I so badly wanted to express. And I listened to some of your other podcasts about some filmmakers that, you know, have taken a lot of time between watching, you know, their films, mm-hmm. understandably, because of, you know, just the insane amount of time. And particularly if you're involved in all the parts, which normally if it's a small film, just due to economics, you kind of have to be. So I haven't seen the film in quite a while. However, I think I was able to watch the film with enough distance. You know, you go through all these phases where you just so excited that you've gotten it, you know, that you have made the film. And then of course all the moments that the moments that are just inevitable where, you know, where something you wish you had gotten something a little differently, or you wish the pacing of something had been different that you can't alter because, you know, you only have, you know, two takes of a particular thing. So I definitely went through that, you know, but also I think I felt we got at least for this film, whether someone likes it or not, I felt that everybody, the team, got more of it right than we did wrong, you know? So, so the last time I did view it, I tried to kind of distance myself so that I wasn't kind of self-critiquing myself as the actor and myself as the writer and everything else, tried to just get distance, I guess, as much distance as I could, so that I just watching it as an, you know, as what experience it was for me. For me, it was a pretty surprising good experience. And then I think for me personally, I think I had a, like an epiphany or a release of like why I had been carrying this story around for so long and why it was so important for me to complete it. And I felt kind of just an immense kind of a feeling of gratitude that I was allowed to experience seeing the film in a way that for me personally was a release and a kind of, a bit of a healing experience for me of letting go of this part of my life. So it was just a lot of appreciation, I guess, my experience. And all that said, like, obviously I know it's not perfect. It's all these other things. But that alone, I felt it's a pretty big gift that was given to me, this experience. I also think I had this other, realization, which sometimes I feel like, at least this particular story for me, almost felt like when I watched it this time, the last time I've seen it, almost like I had taken something difficult and something kind of painful and reimagined it, you know, to have an outcome that I wanted. So, and that was kind of a cool revelation. And I don't know if that ever has anything to do with why we watch films or why we write stories, where like if we could go back and, you know, edit our lives or rewrite an ending or rewrite an event over and over and over again in different ways, which I feel like I've kind of done anyway with other, at least certainly plays. I have a lot of different eat me's, I guess. but pretty far out as far as the genre and as far as kind of the tone, you know. So I have a play called Buddy Badette, which is a superhero play about this really sweet nebbishy guy who's always just terribly made fun of and always put down, but he's just like that guy that just keeps getting up and, like, you know, just keeps, you know, keeps moving on. And he's got like a real good buddy and everything, and he's always locked in his locker, always. And this finally, this one time, it's like kind of been bullied to the point of just, you know, where you just can't take it anymore. And his locker starts rattling, and this character, alter ego named Budette, just bursting out of the locker. And, you know, his alter ego is a female, and she's super tall, and she's got these magnificent boobs, and she's got this crazy awesome afro, and her big power is that she can change people into what they hate, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and the way she does it is she shoots these like lasers from her magnificent boobs. It's this crazy superhero journey about this very sweet guy and his alter ego that's trying to make the world a better place, right? And the first people that he are these two real brutal rapists. So he turns them into what they hate, right? Women. And so they spend the whole play having this insane journey, like trying to beat each other up. You know, one of them is constantly beating himself up as they come to terms with what they hate, right? And I think I come at things from a lot of different points of view as I try to kind of understand them. I think particularly if it's I don't know how else to say this, but like if it's something personal about yourself that you feel like in the world there are a group of people that don't like you for this thing, right? Whether it be
right,
whatever it is, everybody has every. I'm sure, you know. Unfortunately, everybody can relate to this in different ways. I think for me anyway, there's just such a, need or drive to get to the bottom of it, right? To get to the source of it. And there you go. And it shows up in my creative life where I'm turning things kind of inside out and upside down and putting people together with people in really unique emotional situations in order for me to examine something in a way that I guess I'm hoping will get me to a place probably of forgiveness, redemption, or whether me or the other character, you know, or the person I'm desperately trying to connect to, I guess, yeah. But I don't know, like lately my writing has definitely been, gosh, hopefully different. You know, a lot of times you always think you're writing something new. It's such a horrible sometimes experience because you'll think I'm done with this topic and I'm writing this new thing that has nothing to do with this other thing. But so often, you know, at the end of the day, you've just written the same thing, but just in a way trickier way, you know, but I'd like, you know what I mean? Like it takes place on another planet. Like, you know, like you've done all these things to sort of get as far away from the thing. And then yet when you pull back again, you're like, man, I keep writing about the same thing. But I do think I am writing about maybe similar things that engage me, but definitely different subject matter, you know? Probably just said so much there.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I've always felt like your writing is very empathetic. You know, whether they're good guy characters or bad guy characters, and I don't know that Eat Me necessarily has, you know, good guys and bad guys. They're just sort of flawed people at the end of the day. But whatever it is, you know, your writing really, you know, kind of cuts, you know, right to the core of, you know, who they are and sort of what sort of makes them the way that they are.
Mm. I guess always what interests me is all of our imperfections. So yeah, I'm usually not super interested in like a really pure sort of perfect victim. Cause I think that, you know, I speaking for myself, I shouldn't speak for, I'm certainly not perfect. And I have, you know, things about myself that I'm like, ugh, you know, that I have to, you know, that I'm aware of my own demons, my own sort of monsters, my own things that are ooky, you know. Maybe that also comes from like this idea, a sort of historical idea of so often putting victims on trial, you know, like their worthiness, you know, like, well, you know, how much sympathy do they deserve based on, you know, how good of a person they are, you know, how innocent and all these other things. And I think so often the journey of someone, for some people, it just could be a mind fuck, you know?
Right.
I think it always trying to find some way to understand in order to, I guess, to feel like, I guess just sort of the source of where we all come from, right? There has to be a source that, that makes us all just kind of drop everything. And this conversation, I think, is particularly hard now, not because obviously we're so far away from that. Not to say that we probably always have been. It's just so clear right now. And so I think it's an incredible, challenging time for empathy, you know?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really is. And yeah, understandably, it's just, I understand sometimes the need for definitive good, bad. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I understand that. I understand that that at times it makes sense and it's necessary.
Sometimes people are more comfortable thinking of people in sort of absolute terms, that you know that they're either monsters, or you know they're virtuous and not really, you know, in between.
Mm, yes, yes, and I think the time we are in is definitely makes it extra challenging to feel like we're all human, you know. I don't have a good answer or remedy, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, well, and that's, I think that's a challenge. I think there's not, you know, because there's not really a clear cut answer, to that. Mm. So you know, so in Eat Me, you've got essentially two characters for, you know, the majority of the film. You know, we have Tommy, who's, you know, essentially our protagonist, who, you know, we follow her right from the start. And then, you know, her interaction with Bob, and it's really their dialogue that forms, you know, the heart of this movie. And they're both clearly troubled, and they both have, you know, sort of are dealing with it in, you know, in sort of it's very very different ways. And I don't know, I guess maybe in some ways, you know, stereotypically along gender lines, but in other ways not.
Yes, I agree. They both, I think, have a lot of shame and anger. I think Tommy's anger is more turned inward. You know what I mean? Turned right. inward, but definitely anger. He's definitely very, very angry. Whereas I think his character is much more obviously outwardly angry. I also feel like his wounds and his way of, he has a much more difficult time even acknowledging or even knowing what, you know, in what ways he's been, you know, abused, severely abused.
Right.
I think because his, I think sometimes when pain and how we react to that pain, particularly if we're monstrous, you know, we to be present, to be quiet, to be like in ourselves, I think is very terrifying because the bridge is so far. Do you know? We've kind of left the building, or we've left our humanity. We've gone so far, far away from it that I think to even to come back or to touch on it is almost just too much, you know, like too much to touch on. And this particular evening, right, they're both kind of asked to touch on these very, very dangerous places in themselves and scary places in themselves, and to speak things that we might feel that we're just so terrified to speak. You know, in this way, these two characters, there's a relief. I think there's a relief offered when they discover, although so different and although the stories are different, right? The pasts are different, but the sort of humility and the vulnerability and the sort of the truth, even if it's not my truth or your truth, but their truth is spoken, it's true for them, is vulnerable. Do you know? It's right. I think we all have little things throughout our lives where we have a thought. You know, it might be just, this is so completely separate from me, but like there's sometimes when you're a teenager, you might have a just this weird period of time where, like, maybe, at least for me, like my mom would go to like hug me, and I just had oh God, like how long do I have to stay within this hole? It was just such a ugh feeling for me during a certain time. This is just like one simple example. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to think I'm being repulsed by my mom right now. I don't know why. You know, my mom is a great person. Like, I'm not suggesting anything. But so often we push away these truths, right? These moment truths. And it can feel, I think sometimes as being human can feel very profoundly lonely and very isolating. Just simply by the fact that we're all trying to kind of live by this unspoken and yet real way of being and thinking, you know?
It's uncomfortable, I guess, being vulnerable in a lot of ways.
Very, very. And even sometimes I think even just on our own alone, you know, the times when you might have a thought that you're like, you just push it away so quickly that you don't even allow the thought to come fully in, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think for whatever reasons, usually I tend to be a person that will allow those thoughts, those moments to come in and allow them to be and allow myself to figure out or allow myself to sit with them and be uncomfortable and move through them. And I certainly do that with my characters and my stories. I was going to say when we were talking about kind of that idea of culturally, there are times when like something really needs to be said, this is bad, this is good. And I think with Eat Me, I think that a lot of obviously criticism is about forgiveness of a character in the film that you know, rightfully so, a lot of people would say is not forgivable, is not redeemable.
Right.
I do think, though, however, that our personal, not communal, but our personal needs can be that for me, Jacqueline, in order for me to feel better in my life, I might need to forgive someone that certainly my community doesn't need to, you know, mm-hmm. but I need to in order for me
right.
to feel free, right? To feel
right.
free.
Well, that's what they say. Experience. That's what they say a lot of the times is that, you know, forgiveness is not about the person you're forgiving and whether they deserve it. It's about you as the one giving forgiveness and you deserving peace.
Yes. And I tend to feel like when you identify yourself as a victim, I feel like it's very disempowering. So, you know, mm-hmm. If it feels to me like I've given my power away. And I think that's a big journey of the of what I was searching for in Eat Me and why it takes the twists and turns that it does.
Sure.
Of finding a way, even though it, yeah, a primitive way.
in sort of her final act of empathy for Tommy, I mean, she is, you know, sort of by forgiving Bob and what he's done, you know, she's sort of allowing herself to finally sort of, you know, be at peace and come to terms with herself.
Yes, I think that's very true. And that weird kind of thing where we all have our own barometers of good and bad within ourselves, you know, what may look very like very irrational self-judgment to someone else feels really rational to me. Do you
right.
know?
Well, no, that's true. So you said mm-hmm. something a moment ago that I wanted to kind of circle back to, because on this last rewatch, you know, something stood out to me, which I, you know, sort of, I guess, intrinsically noticed every time I've watched it in the past, but this time it really kind of jumped off the screen at me, and that's you know, obviously there's a very brutal scene where Bob, played by Brad Carter, is, you know, he's assaulting Tommy. He is raping her, or at least attempting to rape her. And you know, it's a very, you know, there's a lot of brutal visceral violence. And then sort of immediately following that, he finds, you know, the suicide note that she's left in the bathroom. And she is more, it struck me that she is more visibly upset and bothered by him wanting to read her note than she was, you know, by the assault that just happened.
That's so interesting. I think it's a different type of invasion. And I think it's the role, right? The sort of role that she's putting on to survive or get through this insane evening.
Right.
Is kind of the protection, and the note in the bathroom is just very, very, very unprotected. and when I think about it too, honestly, like if I was to really look a little deeper with this question or observation you're making, I do think that Tommy does not give her full story to Bob, you know?
Right.
I don't think she shares her full story at all. That I think there are glimpses of in that note that are just too vulnerable That's a good observation. I agree.
So yeah, and let's, so we don't ever really get Tommy's story, and I think maybe this is one of the things that makes it so interesting. You know, clearly it seems at least clear to me that she is suffering from depression. Mm-hmm. And there's one part where you have this monologue, you know, talking about this you know, this wedding day tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, that story would give context and explain, you know, why someone would be suffering some severe depression, why they would be, you know, sort of living in, you know, in this sort of filthy state of, you know, distress and disarray that we see in the, you know, in the sort of the opening, in the opening act. Mm-hmm. It's at least in the text, but I assume even from the subtext that she's not telling, you know, a story from her life and something that happened. It's just this fantasy and this idea that has run through her head.
Yes.
But being depressed and suffering from depression is not something that you are required to earn. You know, your depression is just as valid, even if there's not some, you know, horribly, you know, tragic event that, you know, preceded it.
I agree. I fully agree, but I don't think that that's actually, though, often the reality of a person that's very depressed, especially if you have, right, people mm-hmm. around you that you live with. There is tolerance and understanding is really pressed, I think, in the reality of those, of the situation. You know what I mean? I think her that fantasy comes from not her feeling that she needs to have witnessed these things, or that it's her feeling that if all of these things had happened to me, it's like I can't even say them, but I think I was going to say another fantasy, but I just can't do it. It's a fantasy that allows the world around her, the people around her, to not be able to judge her. But I agree exactly what you're saying, but I don't think that is an actual true way that we deal with people that are really depressed.
No, exactly. You know? Yeah.
I think if we drive by someone's house and we see in their windows and we see like a mad, crazy, hoardery, disgusting scenario, we immediately go, oh God, right? Oh mm-hmm. God, like, I can't believe they live like that, right? Or whatever your thing is, or, you know, she's in her house all day, whatever, drinking, right? Fucking all the guys in town. She goes to the bars, whatever. I do think that there is a judgment. You know, the list could go on, right? Why doesn't she go get therapy? Why isn't she on medication? Whatever it might be. A lot of people, you know, have a really angry reaction when someone kills themselves. It's really, really angry, you know?
Yep.
Sometimes when you're really, really depressed, the other sort of, I think, maddening experience for me anyway, is when my mind is wanting to find the something to hang it on, right? Just something to hang it on, like, because it feels so out to sea when you kind of know, when you kind of acknowledge that it's nothing you can control, that it has nothing to do with your life experience, that it has nothing to do with, I think it's, it can be a little bit scary when you think, oh gosh, it's just my brain, right? My brain is, is not making enough happy chemicals or whatever, or there's some heavy grooves and I can't, and for whatever reasons, right? I can't get out of this repetitive groove. So I think that's her fantasy, you know, like we might all have little weird fantasies, like You know, I don't want to go out on another limb here.
No, you don't have to. No,
Jacqueline, it's only you.
No, it's
like creepy ass.
Yeah, I mean that was one of the things that really spoke to me, even from the first time that I watched it. Is, you know, that I have always, you know, my mind will wander in, you know, sort of those quiet moments. And, you know, and I do, and I have, you know, increasingly lately, you know, just taken steps to, you know, try and block that out, and, you know, and just not let those thoughts, you know, sort of invade. But I think, you know, and I have wondered, you know, if, am I the only one that this happens to? And, you know, and that can't be the case, but so little, you know, little thoughts and fantasies like that are, you know, sometimes surprisingly detailed and depressingly dark, you know, do kind of creep in. You know, and I think it's good to know, you know, that we're not alone in that. It gets back to that sort of isolating nature of the human experience.
I agree. I think that's absolutely, I 100% agree. And I've had a lot of people who have seen Eat Me specifically speak to that moment and say, oh yeah, you know, I've thought about, like, well, if I couldn't, you know, a lot of different types of fantasies. I'm not going to give away other people's individual, awesome, in my opinion, fantasies about that help you evade the judgments and the expectations that the world and we as individuals put on ourselves, you know, and the times that we wish we had permission to simply, you know, not even have to walk across the room. But so I only laugh because it's a relief to feel that universal connection, or certainly with enough people for me not to feel alone in that. I think that's why, for me, that's why I like reading. It's like often why I like watching films, particular films, and reading particular books, because it's very comforting to me when people share their, not so much even their actual life experiences, but their personal thoughts between themselves, you know, and their personal observations. I don't know. I find that to be really comforting, because I think so often, just because we often just obviously don't share that, you know, share that with other people. I'm reading, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but Manizuru. Have you read that before?
No, I haven't.
But she has. Beautiful book. I'm not done with it yet. It's kind of a ghost story, but there's a lot of, in this book, there's a lot of, you know, really quiet observations that the main character makes as she navigates through the world that have been really comforting to me. I've been reading it kind of slowly this month. Yeah. It's an interesting, it's been a real kind of weird, comforting book in the way that we're talking about right now, for me.
Yeah, that's great. When we all need those, you know, we all need those comforting, you know, things at time. I mean, even, you know, and I think maybe we might think we don't as we enter adulthood. It's very common for, you know, for a child to have, you know, a comfort blanket, or, you know, a stuffed animal or something like that. And I think we sort of have this naive belief that is something from childhood, and that, you know, and that as an adult, you know, you should be stoic and strong, and you don't need to be comforted. And, you know, maybe it's different from women and men, but I still think that, you know, regardless of gender, you still to a certain degree, I think, have that kind of, you know, have sort of that sort of external pressure. But I think it is still important that, you know, we have these these places and areas of comfort that we can, you know, that we can seek out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I agree. I got a little puppy was found under a dumpster who's now 11 months old. And, you know, she has a little crate and she has to learn to self-soothe, right? To self-calm, mm-hmm. right? Because I have to leave her and everything else. And I guess the puppies in the pack world, like in where they're from, they would never be alone, right? It would mean death. It just would mean death. They travel together. So they would just never, ever think. So when you first leave often a puppy alone in their crate, like they freak out and they're like calling to the pack, right? They're calling to you like, yo, you know, I'm not going to make it. Like you better come get me, right? You know,
right.
And they have to make this huge adjustment, you know, to, you know, and some dogs can't make it, but some can. Mine's making the adjustment, but you hear her struggling to make this adjustment, right? Because she's going to have to make it, right? For her own well-being. Mm-hmm. But I hear her making the adjustment. And of course I have things in there, right? Like things she likes to chew, things that would allow her to put that anxiety and all that. And over time, her little cries get shorter and shorter as she and I started thinking, I need crate training. You know, I need a crate, like a really great treat. And have, you know, have my partner leave the house for an hour, keep extending it. But yeah, it's a trip, you know. The things, the different, I think so often there's different stages of our lives that we're just completely unprepared for. And I always feel like those are the stages too, where like big decisions are often made. Like at this age, like everybody's getting married. And I always feel like, it feels like that's just because that's a really terrifying time. And you're just looking for someone else to jump off the abyss with. Like you start kind of tracking, you know, these moments. But
seeking a friend for the end of the world.
Yeah, seeking a friend. So I don't know what I'm doing from here on out. I have to not live at home anymore. yeah. And then I think if you don't, I don't know, like there's so many, I think the older you get too, the more you understand like, oh yeah, you know, it, certain things, the comfort, you know, my grandmother, you know, would pray, you know? And I remember like peeking my eyes open because I love to watch my grandmother pray and she'd like make her eyes really tight. Like as tight as you could make them, and her hands would be so tight. She would just be praying so, you know, all in. And I would just peek to watch her, you know, watch her do this. And you know, it just brought, that was, I think, her way of soothing, right? That was the way of finding comfort. Or that was the way of getting through things that were really fearful for her. I personally didn't go down that route, so I'm still like, maybe I should have. Would I feel really, really afraid of the world or something personal? Like, it's, for me, it's always been like getting kind of close to the ground, you know, mm-hmm. to the actual ground. And I feel real comforted outside, you know. With trees and like ants and things, you know, for some reason. I think everybody has different things that during different times that hopefully, you know, can let us, just like if you hold a little child, can let us know it's going to be okay.
Right. Right.
You know, I think sometimes being a human, right, it's such a, we're so incredibly simple and yet so kind of complicated. You know, like I remember reading a while ago about like how our brains were developed and how they developed so quickly. And it's like almost like we built a foundation and then we just started doing add-ons and it's all kind of real clumsy and just, you know, toppled on top of each other. So you have like that real primitive part of our brains, like low, like the basement. And then, you know, and in this kind of ramshackle way of putting it all together, and all these different parts of our brains, that primitive kind of lizard self that's trying to communicate with like the upper levels of our house. And I'm like, wow, I think we have to be a lot more gentle with ourselves, you know, navigating kind of the different voices and the different needs, you know, like right. That feeling, like that, would our bodies, you know, when our bodies react before our brains do, like you smell fire, like we have all these fires here. And when you smell fire, like it, for me anyway, makes my body kind of shake. Like there's a primitive, you know, part of myself that's like fire, you know, like do things, you know, run, you know, or whatever it is. And then there's this other part of my brain, right? That's able to negotiate, you know, it's far away. You've got your water, whatever it is. I sometimes think it's miraculous that we, that we get through.
Sure.
I don't know. And then other times, right, where it all just feels so simple. Like I think during this time with the pandemic and everything, it's extra challenging to sure. feel connected. And I think so many of us feel so very lonely, you know, and it just even missing like just simple interactions that we, you know what I mean? Just simple little interactions that we would normally have in the day that you don't even think of as being, you don't really think of as being that special. And then when they're taken away, you're like, wow, I really miss that really simple interaction, you know, with the person who takes my money or my credit card at the grocery store, you know?
Right.
Yeah. You have kids, right?
Yes. Yeah, I have two.
Do they have like blankets and stuff to make them feel good?
So my older one in particular, we got him a weighted blanket. He got one, I think for Christmas, and he's really liked that. And I think it, you know, just sort of helps him sleep, and that's really been very positive for him. So, they're older. They're both older now. They're both, I'm on the verge of having two teenage boys in the house.
Wow.
So that'll be exciting.
Yeah, it will be exciting, I would think. I don't have any children. I will completely miss that experience. But it seems like such an immense, amazing experience to have.
Yeah.
When I was little, my favorite, even now, sometimes one of my favorite places I like little spaces for sure. You know, like closets or, under the bed, just small spaces. Yeah, I do.
I've definitely had to pry him out of a few spots over the years.
Little places.
Yeah, when they crawl into a tiny, tiny cupboard and then realize that they can't get out.
Well, I had one parent that at times I had to be with that was very volatile. And there was a place under my bed that I could get to for a period of time that he simply couldn't get to. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of amazing. Little place that had to do with the center of my bed, as well as kind of holding onto the slats, you know?
Yeah.
That I remember.
So we're talking about, you know, sort of being, comfort and, you know, comfortable spaces and things like that. This screenplay is obviously very visceral. There's a lot of, you know, sort of visceral, brutal violence that's perpetrated on Tommy. If I recall correctly, you filmed this in your home, or what was your home at the time? Did that make things easier in terms of, having to, do a lot of the extreme, stunts and lines and things like that?
I actually think I would have preferred somewhere else. definitely would have preferred somewhere else. Just is super weird to have, people, like the crew showing up, you know, at your own house and they know it's your house, just like a boundary issue, you know, it's sure. just a little bit, even though I obviously kept it, you know, very professional, you know, like, but I had to be up earlier than a normal, obviously, like actor call, because I'd have to be up for the first really sweet PA person coming with coffee and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't just like roll, you know, I couldn't be like open in my robe because, you know, creepy, right? You know, I had to be dressed and like have on like my, I'm a professional, come on in at 5 a.m. So it was, but the, so in some ways it was, I didn't like it, but obviously we had a really great house that was very well suited to be shot in. You know, it's a very open, it's just very camera friendly here, the house. And obviously it saved us so much money to not have to pay for a location that we were able to use for other things that we really needed. We tried really hard to find a location. I mean, my original idea was that it would be shot in Missouri, you know, in a rural area and in a family home. You know, the idea for me was that this was a family home that had generations and generations worth of memories.
I was going to say, you get that sense because there are the old photos that you see on either on the walls or just sort of stacked up around, like there's like black and white family pictures and things like that. So,
yeah. And I think the production designer, Noelle Knight, who's also a very good friend of mine, we both talked a lot about hoarding and memories, family history, being, you know, just overwhelming in the house. And so in that way, I guess I was kind of fortunate to shoot here, certainly as an actor, because all the family photographs were all my family, you know, mm-hmm. all of my history of family that has died. And so I was able to also use like a lot of furniture that's pretty old and that goes way back in my family as well. And also I think for the production designer, it was pretty amazing because she was before doing the film, this film, she's an artist, she's a visual artist and a installation artist. So she really approached the whole film as an installation. So she spent, gosh, you know, at least a month, if not longer, in our house designing. I should do something where I show more photographs. But she, the details of like even the post-its, like the crazy reminder notes that were mm-hmm. all over the refrigerator, all that was Noelle. And then all of like the water stains, all of that was all Noelle. So that was Noelle really just using our house as really approaching it more like a installation art piece that we then got to film in. So then also once we filmed, we never had to kind of reset another side of the house. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was already done. It was already ready to go. And of course we shot, that was the other way we were able to, we had to shoot this film so fast. I think we shot the whole film in 10 days with one day off. So, you know, that's a heavy schedule.
Right. Yeah. That's
yeah. So in some ways, I mean, obviously, listen, I was grateful that we happened. I mean, we were the last ones to think that the house was the right place to shoot, because of course, I don't think I wanted to think that, but the producers were like, you know, we could save a lot of money. When we had like a meeting here, I guess, or something, shooting right here. And every single space in this house, with the exception of one bathroom, which was used.
I do love the way that it's staged, and I think it really just ties into the story well. And it's one of those things that, you know, you put a lot of work into, and you know, and it's almost hard to notice, I think, for a lot of people because they're so wrapped up in the story.
I so appreciate you saying that. I think the director, Adrian, really wanted to obviously serve the story as as best he could with of course the financial and time limitations that we had. So having the whole house kind of ready to shoot with every kind of detail accounted for, like all of the details that Noelle did painstakingly, you know, details. And we did rehearse as much as we, you know, as much as we could. We rehearsed in the house with the cinematographer, Nick Trakonis, and with Adrian, so that we could shoot it in the amount of time that we wanted to. We simply didn't have time to do like an extra take for performance, you know?
Sure.
And I know that this would be obviously a conversation more with Adrian because I didn't direct it, but I know that he did make some decisions that were pretty bold as far as like choosing shots that would mean there wouldn't be a lot of alternatives to edit, you know? And I know it's like kind of a balance for him of wanting to, I think visually he wanted the film to feel safe, you know, versus like handheld and shaky. Like he wanted, I think, the audience to feel like it was thoughtful, you know?
Right.
And I think that was also for this type of film and the subject matter, it was a real nice feeling, at least for myself, and I think for a lot of the crew as well, that kind of thoughtful control in such a kind of raw, visceral, chaotic subject that we were filming, you know?
Right, right, yeah. and that's important to get the right, you know, to get the right feel in the final product, because there's... It could easily, in the hands of I don't want to necessarily say a lesser director, but just I guess in the hands of, you know, of a director maybe who is approaching the subject from a different perspective, it's a kind of film that could very easily turn exploitative, and it really doesn't. And I think that it's a stronger film for it.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, and a lot of people, I had many opportunities to do this film before I did it. Financially, anyway, none of them were like, oh, I'm going to, they weren't hard. In other words, I was really, truly always in a position of just creatively making a decision. There was never anything that, you know, tempting. I don't want to say like, oh, these offers came to me. It wasn't really like that. But I did have opportunities. I, of course, was very afraid of it. I knew the dangers of this. The script is dangerous. The subject is dangerous. I knew all that. And I really needed to be surrounded by people that I really trusted and that I knew were attracted to the piece for the reasons I needed them to be. You know, I think it would have been real easy for someone to be like, I'm going to make this, you know, this freaking, you know, whatever, shocking, crazy shit and fuck it and... I just needed to feel so safe so I could turn it over to someone. And I did feel that way. I really did feel that way. And I know it is a hard film to watch, especially at particular times. And our hope was that where we go, that it will be, that the cost is worth the journey, right?
Right,
you know, and
right.
I think some people will say yes, and maybe, and probably some people will say no, but that was the intention for all involved. And I think that's sometimes the tricky nature of our film, or any film that deals with violence, is how, you know, how do you kind of fully honor the event? You know,
right.
You know, how do you film it? How do you show it? How much do you show of it? And of course, all those questions are answered differently depending on just obviously, you know, depending on the story of the film. For me, it was really important to see the horror of what this character is of what the horror that Bob is expressing and the horror that Tommy is witnessing or taking,
right,
in order for the other moment, in my opinion, to have any power or any realistic value, you have to experience the hard parts. I think, you know, I could feel differently later, but that is certainly how we felt then, how I felt at least the last time, which has been a while since I viewed the film, you know?
Right.
There were pros and cons, definitely pros and cons about shooting in your own space. You know, you can clearly, the great thing is, like, we had the space to get ready for as long as we wanted. And then I think I told you this, that we did one day of reshoots, which took a whole year to do, to get the money to do.
Oh, wow.
And we lived essentially in that crazy set for a year. And if you see the film, you'll understand why we couldn't just, there would be no way, you know, we shot the film pretty much in real time. The whole film takes place in a 24 hour period, but we shot the film,
consecutively. Yeah.
Because of the mad craziness and destruction that happens, but also because the person who lives, the character that lives in this house, is a hoarder. So the amount of trash, you know, the amount of trash and stuff, and being able to, for continuity, to be able to, mm-hmm, to ever store it, put it back how it was, like that made my brain hurt more than being like, I'm living with it.
Right.
And I think that, I'm sure that our mailman and stuff, I mean, I don't know what he thought. I think, I don't know what he thought, because I had to keep all the curtains, everything shut up, because it looked crazy. And I had blood on the ceiling, I had blood on the walls. I mean, real deal, crazy looking house for about a year.
Wow.
So if somebody came to the door, if I didn't know them, I certainly didn't let them see past me, because they would, exactly going back to what we were talking about, they would think, crazy ass hoarder,
right,
with blood on her ceiling, like what? and her ceiling needs repair, you know, which it did, and it was all pretend, you know, ceiling stains and stuff, but
right,
it all looked good now. I have one little tiny spot where there's some blood, obviously pretend blood. There's like a good splattering of blood that only I ever noticed. It's on some bricks, so I could take it. I don't know, just something about it. It's like the memento. I don't know. It's like a I don't know. That's like the only area of the house that I didn't fix. It would take probably maybe 10 minutes to sort it, but I don't know, something kind of, I guess it's a, you know, like a memory,
sure,
that I like.
Right, right.
It's a memory that I like of it. But it was incredible, I have to say. All of the, you know, oh, it's hard and shooting it in 10 days. And it was. But it was also mostly, it was so surreal. It was so surreal to have this thing that I wanted so badly to be happening, you know,
mm-hmm,
that I never felt tired. You know, during the whole time, I was so, just couldn't believe it was happening. And you know, it's anytime you write, whether it's a play or a film, the amount of people that are involved in taking your flat words on a paper and making it real. I mean, it's just an overwhelming feeling of kind of gratitude, because of how many people it takes to make it dimensional and to make it this living thing. You know, it's a real, it's a, really, it never ceases to be an amazing trip, you know?
Right.
Yeah, from the first read through, and then when you see like the actual set, and then you see how many different individuals with their, you know, individual, point of view. And yeah, it's just, it's a massive collaboration.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, and then in film, of course, different than theater, it's different in the fact that once the train starts, it's so fast. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That you absolutely need all these individuals just focused on their specific thing, because it's everything's moving too fast for one person to be able to to possibly navigate all that moving train.
right.
I would love to do another film again. Oh, and we did, you know, with the director, we did a couple of short films together before we did Eat Me. So, because his background was more directing and theater, so he wanted to, you know, there's a lot of practicing.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Practicing how you work together and, you know, I think making anything is amazing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I really do hope that both you and Adrian get some more opportunities to make movies. I really appreciate you've been very generous with your time today. And so I want to thank you for, making yourself available to do this. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. Hopefully I didn't just blah, blah too much.
It's fantastic.
I want to say I so appreciate you as well. There's so many little films and voices that that are like me, that are like wherever I am, and sometimes I feel like little voices out there, like in this with so much content and so much, obviously amazing. Big, amazing things to be seen and experienced. So I so appreciate you being such a, advocate of our little film and of other filmmakers' movies as well. It's so needed, and it's really, really appreciated. And it is a good reminder, because I think so often we forget even that we did this thing. So it's it was nice for me to remember, and listening to some of your other podcasts with other filmmakers, it's inspiring. It's inspiring and kind of gives me some needed energy to attempt to do another film.
That's great.
Which for a while seemed incredibly daunting.
I'm sure it does, but that's great. And I thank you. I appreciate you saying that. And that is, what I hope to do, with this podcast, really ultimately is to inspire people. If all that ends up happening is, a few more people get to see some of these movies that I'm talking about, then mission accomplished.
Yeah, I agree fully. And I certainly I saw Bagman, so I have a list now, right. I'm excited. You know,
one movie a week. You know, just check out something that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. That's all I ask.
Yeah.
All right. Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you, honey. Okay, bye. Much love. Bye.
Okay, and thanks everyone for joining me for another episode. Thank you again to Jacqueline Wright for being my guest. The movie is called Eat Me from 2018. You can find it on VOD everywhere and on DVD from Blue Fox Entertainment. Feel free to send any feedback to notsuitablepod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter. I am NSFAPod or @FinHorror. Drop me a line and let me know what you think of the show.